I understand that given the way creation is, given the way God set things up, the principles he built into the universe, including those for man, struggle and suffering can lead to good and are one of the ways to achieve good in the next world and this world. So that's a principle that God put into creation, is that suffering can and often does lead to good. That struggle can and often does lead to good. Again, given that he understands that these things are good, why did he build that principle into creation?
Yeah, I have said for many years that that is an impossible question to answer, because any analysis you get can only create logic within the structure of things that we know. In other words, when you make a logical argument, you're basically saying, based on the reality that we see, this system makes sense. But one could always ask, why didn't God create an alternative reality? To analyze the possibility of an alternative reality within the framework of the reality that we're in is really a question that we cannot answer. In other words, I don't mean to be flippant, but if you think about it, any logical argument we make is based on laws of logic that are in effect inferred by the experience of the reality that we are within, and therefore they cannot be used to address an alternative reality for which we are not within. So really, I think in many, many ways it's an impossible question. We can simply say the following. Given human personality as we know it, a human can grow from suffering more than he can grow from comfort and complacency. That's the reality. In other words, we look at human beings, people who are not challenged, people who are not stimulated, people who don't have to go beyond their comfort zone, remain in a greater stagnant state of spiritual growth than people who are challenged. Right? That is what we see. Therefore, based on what we see, we can infer that there is a role, an important role, for suffering, adversity, and the like. But that is a logical argument, only on the basis of the fact that we see that complacency does not stimulate growth. Now, you could always say, well, couldn't God make a world where complacency, you know, forgive my reference here, one of the very early Woody Allen movies, going back, you know, before you guys were born, going back to the middle 60s, involved something, I don't even remember what it was, I don't even think I saw it, I think I just, actually just, in defense of myself, I believe I just read the review, but I think that might be true even, somehow he comes back into a future world where he discovers that, you know, broccoli poisons you, and really the thing that prolongs your life are high-fat food and ice cream and cake. And the whole reality is different. That's like a wonderful world. Well, wow, you know, you can eat anything you want, all the junk food, and that's going to be good, right? So you can always ask the question, well, why did God make broccoli healthy and ice cream, you know, not so healthy? You know, it could have been the other way around, right? So I do think at some point, you know, this is what Chazal say in Maseches Chagiga, that you can only analyze what is under the sun, and you can't, in other words, you cannot really analyze what is beyond the sun. Because in truth, any argument you make for anything, you could always say, well, why couldn't God have made it another way? So, again, I'd be interested to see what Rabbi Gottlieb would say to this, because I honestly feel that there is literally no possible way to answer that argument, because all logic is based on the world as we find it. So I'm sorry if I can't give you a good solution. Yeah.
Could Rob give us an insight into the life and teachings of Rabbi Kaplan?
Well, Rabbi Kaplan is a bit of an enigmatic person. You know, he died tragically young, and you know, we don't have an extensive biography of him. Rabbi Kaplan, I believe, was himself a Baal Teshuva, I think. I don't want to say 100%. And he became religious around high school age. He went to Torah Vadas, yeshiva. He also had a graduate degree in physics, all but dissertation. So he did not get a doctorate, but I think he completed doctoral work. And his early career was in Jewish education on a relatively basic level. He was in Louisville, Kentucky, and he taught in a community day school. I think he may have become the principal of the day school, but he was not teaching at some high level a yeshiva, so he was dealing with kids from largely non-Shomer Shabbos families. But as someone who liked to learn, you know, in addition to his teaching, he began to write, and eventually NCSY, you're familiar with NCSY? NCSY is a youth organization largely of non-religious kids or kids who became religious, either from public schools or the like. And he began to write a number of pamphlets and small booklets for NCSY, such as explaining tzitzis, explaining tefillin. He wrote a book, What If You Were God, etc. And all of these were small books. But, you know, he had a tremendous amount of knowledge, both not only of Gemara, but also he delved in Kabbalah and the like. And as he got older, he spent more and more of his time in Kabbalah, and his works began to get more deeper and more expansive. And so a book like Inner Space is an introduction to Kabbalah. Other books have a Kabbalistic twist. Judaism and Meditation, he became very interested in how to integrate, because this was during the 70s, when more and more Jews were turning to Buddhism because of meditation and the like. And he tried to show that meditation was consistent with Judaism, and in fact, that is how the prophets attained prophetic states, by meditation. And you probably are familiar with his famous trilogy, on three volumes on Jewish meditation. One is called Jewish Meditation, one is called Meditation and the Bible, and the other is called Meditation and the Kabbalah, where he goes over all of these things. So he did get married. He had a family of 10 children. He died tragically young, in his 40s. I don't remember, I think I've been 48, but I don't remember for sure. And I have to say, this will scare you off, that there is a history of great Mekubalim dying very young. The Arizal, the greatest of the Mekubalim, died at 39. Rav Moshe Cardovero, also an extremely great Mekubal, died at 48. And Rabbi Kaplan himself writes in one of his books on meditation and the Kabbalah, where he talks about meditating on the name of Hashem, he actually says, do not do this if you are alone. You have to have a buddy to kind of bring you back to earth, because when a person meditates on Hashem's name, your neshama can be so connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's essence that it literally wants to leave the guf and doesn't want to come back, and that means you die. So you need somebody to kind of slap you in the face or pull you back to earth to remind you not to leave. So my completely unsupported speculation is that maybe Rabbi Kaplan may have been ignoring his own advice. I could imagine, just as an imagination, that he was delving into Kabbalah on a deeper and deeper and deeper level. And unfortunately, we do find that that's what happens. The neshama leaves the guf because of its great, great devekus in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Rabbi Kaplan was very uniquely situated for a lot of reasons. Number one, because of his scientific background, he was able to address how Torah views things like evolution, age of the earth, and the like. Number two, he was able to integrate Kabbalah into the normal presentations of Judaism. And number three, because he was both a Baal Tshuva and he worked with people who were not from a religious background, like in Louisville and the like, he was able to understand the types of questions they had, and he was able to express himself in a way that they would be able to understand. So, of course, in addition to everything else, by the way, he also did an excellent translation of the whole Torah. It's called The Living Torah. Perhaps you've seen it, with many, many footnotes. And just look at the number of Mefarshim he consulted, you know, like 300 Mefarshim he consulted. Later people completed it on all of Nach. Now he only did these five books of Moshe. Somebody else did it on Nevi'im and Kesuvim as well. So he was a very, very extraordinary person. And again, it's a very tragic loss for Am Yisrael, and certainly for his family. I don't know if you had a specific question about Rabbi Kaplan.
Yes, just in addition to how his personal teaching viewed by the Torah.
Well, how are they viewed? Well, I think he's one of the people that almost everybody respects. Now, maybe because he died young, maybe if he had been living longer, he eventually would have gotten into trouble with people. But I think that everybody does have a very deep respect for Rabbi Kaplan, and even people who would normally tell you, it's like a common thing you'll hear, maybe you probably even hear it or Sameach. Somebody says, I want to learn Kabbalah, you know. So they'll say, well, don't read anything except Rabbi Ari Kaplan. That's a common answer, a common way that people talk, as if to say, everything else, you know, is suspicious and we're not really sure, but that's considered to be a good source. So I think he was a person that was zocha to a shame tov that people are mekabel his teaching. So you would be on safe footing. Yeah.
I was wondering if the Rav could give us a bit of a mahalach with how we should relate to machloekes in between gedolim, especially with what we're seeing today.
Yeah, this is an awful thing. There is, somebody, just to give you an example, I think I may have mentioned this, somebody wanted to discuss the issue. Did Chazal have a sense of humor? So, you know, we discuss it back and forth. So I have an ironclad proof that Chazal have a sense of humor, because the Gemara in Brachos says, Talmidei Chachamim bring peace into the world. And that is as funny as you can get. this is the proof that Chazal have a sense of humor. And I heard this from a Rosh Hashiva, well, not name, but I heard it from a Rosh Hashiva who actually said this. It's not just me. So this is a very, very difficult thing. And it's difficult for you guys. It's difficult for me. It's difficult for a whole bunch of B'nai Torah. My answer has to be, in a sense, how do you relate to it, is basically don't relate to it. Just basically say, there are important issues here. The issue is, how do we respond to the draft? And again, there are many different deists. There are deists, not so much in the Haredi world, but there are religious deists that say, hey, we should support, participating in the war. You know, this is an issue. The Dati Leumi community believes that military service for the state of Israel is a mitzvah. So there are those that say it's a mitzvah. There are those that say it's the biggest tragedy in Klal Yisrael to take people away from learning. There are those that are kind of in the middle. Some people should go, and some people shouldn't go. So I think you have to understand that when people feel passionately about something, you know, they express themselves with a lot of islavos, and that's even more true in Eretz Yisrael, where feelings are very, very strong. But I think you just have to understand that, number one, the particular Lashonos that are being bandied around are not necessarily the Lashonos of the Gedolim. The fact that people say the Gadol said so-and-so means nothing, because it's no proof. I know this myself. I have seen signs representing what Rav Yashiv said about something, and I was happy. I remember I was at a shir once on Shabbos. Rav Yashiv used to give a shir on Shabbos when he was well. And I would go occasionally. In a sense, it was one of those things that even if you didn't even understand the shir, it was kind of fun to watch, because it's one of those things where, like, people are throwing, like, every possible, like, attack on him. And, like, you know, he's, like, swatting it away like mosquitoes. You know, people say, and, you know, there were lamdanim there. People would ask, you know, really hard kashas, and he'd say, like, you know, don't you know the Rashba and Nida and Daftam? And they said, Machlokas Chazanish Mikitzavis, like, you know, what are you bothering me, you know, type of thing. So I remember one time, that somebody said, according to the Rav, according to what the Rav is saying, the halakha should be so-and-so. Something like Hilchos Shabbos. And Rav Yashiv, like, shrugged his shoulder. He said, So I see the next day, I'm walking on Shmuel HaNavi, I see a gigantic sign in a window that says, the Pose Kador Maran Hagon Rav Yashiv Shalom Yashiv has paskin the certain thing is usher DRS. Now, the context was, it was the middle of a shir, and Rav Yashiv didn't even say any words. The person just said, according to this svora, which you're saying in Tosfos, this thing should arise. Rav Yashiv shrugged, like, maybe. That is not a psak halacha, number one. At most, it was the acknowledgement that somebody was saying a svora, and even that was only in one rishon. See, so what happened was, a little nod to somebody's svora gets turned into a definitive psak halacha. And that was very eye-opening for me, because that made me realize, you know, this was something I personally saw, because I was there on Shabbos. I saw the sign on Sunday. And it made me think that quite a few things are that way. The Gadol Hador says this, and he says this. Well, you know, he shrugged, he nodded, he coughed, you know, whatever it would be. So one of the ways you can deal with it is to understand that a lot of the harshness is not coming from the Gedolim per se. That's one thing. And the second issue is that people feel strongly because these are important issues, but at most, we should try to understand the issues. Let's try to understand the shita. Let's try to understand, in other words, one should understand what is the issue of the army, pro and con. But one should certainly not be mishtatev in any denigration, in any sinaschidam. You know, that's all. But having said all of that, it's still very, very difficult for us to grasp. This is a new level. And some, well, I'm not going to say it's unparalleled, because obviously the Chorban Beis HaMikdash 2,000 years ago was because of sinaschidam. But this is a bit of an unusual configuration, because in a sense, we're cutting the divisions narrower and narrower. I mean, it was religious versus secular. Okay, I can understand that. Hasidim versus Misnagdim. Okay. But now we have a division between Rav Chaim Kanevsky and Rav Shmuel Orbach. I mean, that's like, you know, that's like, you know, that's like taking, you know, how thin can you slice the salami? Like how many differences can you make at that point? I mean, meaning, I would have to say that in their hashkafa of the world, their Talmidim are, you know, 99 point, and I would go like 100 decimal places, you know, and the same on everything. And yet, that .00000, 100 places, one, it creates such bitterness and such machlokas. So it just shows you that, you know, we're still a door that is so involved in machlokas. Yeah.
I was wondering if Rob could help shed some light on terms of chinuch, where the idea of Klal Yisrael is that, you know, the boys learn yeshiva and they learn gemara, they don't learn about families much until they're already about to get married, and why women all pretty much learn about raising a family and not any gemara.
Well, it is a very, very good question, interesting question, and that's not to say that some things that women are learning, you know, ought to be taught to men as well. You know, but here's the thing: there is a mitzvah in the Torah called Talmud Torah, right? This is one of the great. This is considered to be the greatest mitzvah, Talmud Torah Keneged Kula, and we know that women are exempt from Talmud Torah, meaning to say their kesher to Hashem is not primarily through learning. Now, we also know, on the other hand, that at least for the past 100 years, women's education has been increasing, the Beis Yaakov system and the like. But this would suggest that the purpose of learning for a woman is not the same as the purpose of learning for a man. Learning for a man, although learning for a man should also embody halacha and practical knowledge and how to live, but learning for a man is a metaphysical way that your neshama connects with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Your neshama absorbs godliness through the process of learning. And that is even if it's a way that's not conscious, because let's say you're not learning about God. In other words, sometimes people are confused. You want to come to yeshiva because you want to learn about Hashem. And instead, you start learning about a guy who's trying to divorce his wife, and you know, he annuls the shaliach, or an egg got laid on Yom Tov, and you know, can you, and a person wonders exactly, this is not about God. Okay, a person wonders, and you know, it's a good question. And yet, the metaphysical answer, which a person might not be able to accept when he begins, is that this is the pipeline that is makasher me to the Ribbono Shel Olam. That it does, in a way we don't fully understand, as I work to understand God's mind and God's seichel, even in the most mundane things, I potentially become a more godly person. So even if it's not about God, even if it's not about things that are spiritual, Torah does do that to you. Now, for a woman, it doesn't work that way. Because a woman's neshama does not get its channel via Limud HaTorah itself. So what is the purpose of a woman learning Torah? To get the direct ideas that will impact on how she will live as a woman, as a wife, and as a mother. So for a woman to learn Gemara, it's not that a woman is not smart enough. I mean, obviously there are women that are smart enough, and there are women that are, you know, smarter than a lot of men. I mean, nobody denies that idea that a woman that can be a lawyer or a doctor or a judge, you know, can learn Gemara as well. And it'll stay in her mind but it's not going to have spiritually that transformative effect. So as a result, even though we have greatly increased women's learning, the orientation and goal would be towards the practical ideas that will enable her to be a wife and a mother. Now, men need those ideas too. I'm not denying that. But the point is that men get something from the theoretical learning of Gemara that a woman would not get. Okay? So this is very hard to understand because we don't really understand how our learning spiritually transforms us. Because ultimately it's a supernatural process. It's not a logical process. It's not logical that by learning, you know, the types of things that the Gemara talks about, it's not illogical you will become a better person. Right? One would not automatically assume that, but that is the situation, or at least potentially it can make you a better person. For a woman, it's not going to make her a better person. You know, maybe it won't hurt her, but it's not. That's not how she becomes better. So as a result, women's learning is based on absorbing emunah, learning how to raise a family, and it's connected to Torah teachings. It is connected, but it has to have that kind of orientation. So I'm not sure if that clarifies it. But having said that, we have to find time and space in the men's yeshivas also, that they should have this hadracha, because it is a chaval that sometimes B'nai Yeshiva don't really learn how to be good husbands and good fathers. And that is something that there needs to be some conscious attention paid to. By the way, it's a funny thing. In some of the more modern women's places, they do learn Gemara. They want to kind of imitate the men. And in truth, you could say that, you know, instead of women trying to imitate the men's yeshivas, we ought to think about men's yeshivas trying to imitate the women's yeshivas, because the truth of the matter is, being freed from Gemara give women a tremendous opportunity to do Tanakh and Halacha and Hashkafa and history and all sorts of things that we're not able to do because of our concentration on Gemara. So in a sense, a woman from in a good seminary can actually have a greater education. In fact, even in Halacha it's that way. I was once at somebody's Shabbos table, and I don't know, some other discussion got about, you know, that the boys in Mir or Brisk were not learning Halacha. So somebody said, well, if you're not learning Halacha, you know, how are you going to paskin Hilchos Shabbos? How are you going to paskin Hilchos Kashrus? So he said, I will marry a wife that can paskin these Shabbos. That's what it is. Yeah.
I was wondering how much emphasis, philosophically speaking, how much significance davening should be the Zimra, as we say after the Shemona Esrei, not knowing pretty much not knowing that really what we're saying. We see the words, we read and translate it, but how, what the purpose of the each Shalom is and
well, you know, yeah. I mean, davening b'chlal is a challenge. Number one, we do it we do it three times a day, so it's very hard to feel a sense of renewal. And also, it's long. I mean, the Jewish Minchat Maariv maybe not, but Shacharis is a long tefillah. And in fact, what do they say? They actually say that Jews have the longest liturgy in the world. You know, the Muslims pray five times a day, but each time is 5 minutes. You know, we have a real long, and Shabbos morning, you know, it's a real long part of the day. It's much longer to have than a church service where you go for half an hour and, you know, and you just leave. But I think at the same time, you know, it is important. I mean, all I can tell you is it is important to at least know the translation of what you're davening, and think about it. And that's a limud, that's part of learning. And I don't necessarily mean to learn a commentary that gives you five different explanations for every word. In fact, that actually is a little counterproductive to Kabbalah, because that turns davening into an intellectual exercise. So Rav Alba actually said a good point. Rav Alba said that one should not try to over-intellectualize davening. Like, what's the difference between this word and this word? You know what I'm saying? Because then it really just becomes, you know, you're davening like you're learning Gemara. And the mindset during prayer is not the same as the mindset during Gemara. So the point of learning about davening is not so much to get sophisticated analyses, but to basically understand a simple explanation that you're talking to Hashem and what you're saying to Hashem. And Psukei DeZimra, I would recommend, is your, even if you don't understand every sentence, the ultimate idea is you're praising Hashem. Okay? And again, you have to understand that the way davening works, the macro and the micro is the same. Let's say the micro, I mean, is Shemone Esrei. Shemone Esrei has three parts: praise, request, and thanksgiving. Right? That's the three parts of Shemone Esrei. But that also applies to davening as a whole, because we say the following. Psukei DeZimra is praise. Shemona Esrei, although it also has praise, request, thanksgiving, is primarily request. And afterwards is primarily thanksgiving. So what you're doing in miniature in Shemona Esrei is what all of davening is doing. You see what I'm saying? The Psukei DeZimra is the praise. Shemona Esrei is mainly the request. And right. So basically, I think if you have this general orientation, I'm now going to spend 15 minutes or whatever your Psukei DeZimra time is. I noticed you took down the time schedule there. I don't know if that was intended or not.
Yeah, we were told that's not the correct.
Oh, yeah. Well, in other words, the concept of time is not correct at all, or just those particular times?
I was supposed to see why
that was up there. Okay, that's interesting. Okay, all right. Very good. Okay. So we're freed. Okay, freed from time. The Laila Min Hazman. But the point basically is that, you know, Psukei DeZimra, you're thinking, I am now going to think about praising Hashem, praising the greatness of Hashem. And then Shemona Esrei, with its praise and thanksgiving, but I'm going to ask Hashem how much I need him. And then I will thank Hashem. Okay, so I think if you think about those general ideas, they can motivate you in different ways. But still, you should learn. You should definitely learn the simple meanings of things. And I think you'll find, you can even find davening enjoyable when you know what you're saying. There actually is something, you know what you're saying, and new thoughts can occur to you, and they can give you a hisoros of kavana. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When the pot shattered and gets re-glued back together with the question about kashrus.
I'm sorry, you're talking about an earthenware? What are you talking about?
The earthenware pot that gets shattered, because by shaking gets shattered and glued back together, and the question is whether it's still not fixed, whether it's still kashrus or not.
Yeah, that's not going to help you because shattering a pot does not kosher it at all. What shattering a pot does is, if the earthenware was ritually tameh because of a mace, so shattering makes it not a kli anymore. But kashrus doesn't help you, because even if it's not a kli, it absorbed the taste. The only way you could the only way, according to all opinions, you can kosher an earthenware kli is by putting it back into the pottery kiln, which is a temperature of around 2,000 degrees, and if it's glazed pottery, that's going to ruin it, so you really can't do that. Now, there is a sheet of the Baal HaItor, which is interesting, who says Kli Cheres, which is earthenware, can be koshered by immersing it in boiling water three times. We generally do not paskin like the Baal HaItor, but if it's very expensive china that you got from your grandmother, and it hadn't been used for a year, so we're mitztaref those two views, and we allow koshering of china, but even that is not for Pesach, so that's kind of a summary. But smashing it is not going to help you.
My question is actually not. The machlokas were in the Gemara about the Tamar pot. I think it was
Rabbi Yeshua. You're going back to that. Yeah. Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer, yeah.
Right, and they argue about, and he's the Walsh, the problem, and the Vasco.
Yep.
The reason we pass it like this, however, so why do we?
Yeah, no, that's a very excellent kasha. And Taisus asked the kasha himself, right? He's referring to the Gemara that says when a baskol came out and said the halakha is like Rabbi Eliezer, the chachamim said back to the baskol, we don't listen to you, Hashem, because lo b'shamayim, the Torah is not in heaven, and therefore even you, Hashem, cannot depart from the rules of the Torah. That's an amazing thing. That says the halacha has to follow the chachamim. And Eliyahu HaNavi said, Hashem was laughing when they said that, and he said, Nitzchuni Banai, my children have been victorious. So the kasha is, on one hand, we have this stand, you don't listen to a bas kol, but yet, in the Machlokas Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, the halacha is like Beis Hillel, and because a bas kol said, the halacha is like Beis Hillel. So here is the difference. The difference basically is this. We don't listen to a bas kol when the bas kol is going keneged the halachic principles that Hashem gave down in the Torah. Now, in the case of the tanur, of the oven, the Torah gave you a principle of following a majority. Rabbi Eliezer refused to follow the majority because he thought they were wrong. A bas kol sided with him. The Chachamim's argument is a bas kol cannot override the halachic rule that all cases of machlokas are resolved by majority. Now, by contrast, in the machlokas Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, the Gemara says Beis Hillel was actually numerically the rov. In other words, in a sense, Beis Shammai was the Rabbi Eliezer position here. And Beis Shammai felt that Beis Hillel was wrong, and therefore we don't have to follow the majority. So the bas kol was kind of a kick, kind of a take notice, meaning follow the halacha. So contrary to the bas kol that's saying don't follow the halacha, this was a bas kol that said follow the halacha. And as a result, the bas kol could tell Beis Shammai that they were not doing the correct thing. That would be the difference. Yeah.
Why do we use the lashon serving God so much, as opposed to something like living in God's ways, or executing God's will, or following God's advice for living well?
Yeah.
Why is it serving God?
Well, I think the word serving is because serving is, of course, connected to the word eved. And the eved, because like this, the eved connotes the idea that I must do Hashem's will, even when it does not make sense to me. Meaning to say, virtually any other term that you're going to use suggests that there has to be a logic and an appeal and an attraction and a logical basis for what I'm doing. And yet, the lesson of the Akedah, right? What is the lesson of the Akedah? Is this notion of that a Jew has to be ready to have unconditional submission, just as an Eved cannot ask any questions. Now, the paradox is, we do have a mitzvah of Talmud Torah, meaning Hashem wants us to try to understand him as much as we can. In other words, it's not Hashem's orientation, just obey and don't try to understand me. We are supposed to try to understand Hashem, but we also have to know that we're going to fail, that we're not going to be totally successful. And that is the idea of the Eved. You know, it's been pointed out that it's very interesting that the central symbol of Christianity is God's willingness, kavyachal, to die for man, the crucifixion. One of the central symbols of Judaism is man's willingness to die for God, meaning to say it's a reversal. The Akedah is exactly the opposite of the Christian symbolism. Again, like John F. Kennedy said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. In other words, ask not what Hashem does for me, and he does plenty, rest assured. Ask what you can do for Hashem. That's the idea of the Eved. So I would say the Eved connects to the Akedah and is that unconditional submission, even if it doesn't make sense to you.
Well, we can't do anything for Hashem.
Huh?
We can't do anything for Hashem.
Well, the one thing we can do for Hashem is obey. Now it's correct. Why? Then you're asking another question. Why does Hashem care? That's a very good question. And the ultimate answer to that is, as the Derech Hashem says, Hashem doesn't care because of him. Hashem cares because of you, meaning to say it is better for you to be connected to Hashem, but that could only be done if you're unconditionally connected to him. So yes, it is true that operationally Hashem expresses us as servitude, but it's a servitude that is ultimately for our benefit. Yeah. This is a fascinating question, and unfortunately, it's nogela maisa, and that is the halachic status of suicide planes. Right, you have a situation where terrorists are commandeering a projectile or a weapon, and if you don't do anything, many people are going to die. Now, obviously, if all you have are terrorists on the plane, that's very simple. That's a rodeif. You shoot down the plane, kill the terrorists. Nobody has any question about that. But the question becomes, when you have a plane that has, let's say, 250 innocent people who have no intention to hurt anybody, and if I shoot down the plane, they're going to die, what do I do? So let me point out, Aliba Diemis, there's an important machlaikas, Rashi in the Rambam, in the 8th parak of Sanhedrin. We know that the normal rule is you can't kill some people to save other people, right? If the guy goes over to you and says, kill him or I'll kill you, and he's not a rodef, you cannot kill, right? But according to Rashi, Rashi says the following, you say it. Rashi says, you can kill a person who is going to die anyway. So consider this example. The goyim go over to you and say, give us Reuven, or we will wipe out the whole city. So according to Rashi, Rashi only, we are permitted to deliver Reuven. And the reason is because if I don't deliver Reuven, the whole city is going to die, including Reuven. So if Reuven is going to die, whether I give him over or don't give him over, isn't it better to have Reuven killed and the rest of the city spared than to have the rest of the city plus Reuven die? Now, that's very different if Reuven wouldn't be in the city. Let's say the goyim would say, get us Reuven from New York, or we will wipe out Chicago. The halacha would say, Chicago is mechuyev to be wiped out. We don't have the right to pick Reuven, even though it's one against a million. The argument of Rashi is not because it's one against a million. The argument of Rashi is the one is going to die anyway. You see the point. Now, according to Rashi, it would appear, since Bederech HaTeva, if the suicide plane is going to crash into the World Trade Center, the 240 passengers are going to die anyway, we're not making a choice between saving 5,000 or saving 200. We're making a choice between saving 5,000 and losing 5,200 people. So according to Rashi, and that's, I know you gave a different reason, I'll get to what you say. According to Rashi, you would actually be allowed to shoot down the suicide bomber. Now, the Rambam is cholik on Rashi. The Rambam says in that exact case, if the goyim say, give us Reuven or wipe out the whole city, including Reuven, you are actually not allowed to give Reuven. You cannot choose the one that's going to die. Even if Reuven's going to die in the city itself. And really, the Machlokas Rashi in the Rambam is actually a Machlokas Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish in these Talmud Yerushalmi. So actually, it's really just a Machlokas out of Paschim. So according to Rashi, you can't kill somebody to save other people just because he's going to die anyway. I'm sorry, according to the Rambam, I meant. Now, but your point is a different point. That is, okay, so let's say you can't kill Reuven to save the rest of the city, but perhaps we could define the rodef, not in terms of the people, but the rodef in terms of the weapon, the airplane. Can the airplane be halachically defined as a rodef, and as a result, be destroyed? That is a possible svara. It seems that the poskim don't look at it that way. You know, it's like the NRA says, guns don't kill people, people kill people, right? So it's like planes don't kill people, it's terrorists who drive planes that kill people. And based on that svara, it would be a little difficult to look at the plane as a rodef when you have innocent people. But, you know, if you'd ask me halacha l'maisa, let's say you're a soldier. Do you shoot down the plane? So you ask a rav. So the rav says, well, it's a machlokas Rashi and the Rambam. You know, that doesn't work for military decision making. Some psak halacha would have to be made. I honestly do not know what the psak halacha is here. Generally speaking, the mahalach of halacha is that Rambam is regarded as a posek. Rashi is regarded more as a commentator and not a posek. I mean, Rashi was a posek, but at least his statements in the Gemara are taken as commentary. So it would seem, al pi the Rambam, you would not be allowed to shoot down the plane. But again, this is a very, very tragic situation. We hope we actually did confront it in 9/11, but they didn't wind up. The U.S. government was contemplating shooting down the plane, but the plane they were going to shoot down was the plane that the passengers themselves crashed. crashed, right? So the Shiloh did not have to be actually carried out. Yeah.
I suppose a follow-up question from that. I mean, everyone knows that there are three Avaras you're prepared to die for.
Yeah.
Now, what if the situation comes up where, you know, they, you know, Goyim or whoever it is who's oppressing the Jewish people will come along and say, well, unless you kill X, we will kill, you know, a whole bunch of other people. Or, you know, if you serve the Avodah Zorah, we will not kill everybody. We'll let them go or whatever. Yeah. Are you allowed to do one of the cardinal sins in order to save lives?
Well, no, because here is the argument. The same way you are not permitted to transgress to save your life, by the same token, you are not permitted to transgress to save anybody else's life. So the heter is not going to be any different. Now, I understand that emotionally, I'm willing to give my life, but how do I have the right to endanger somebody else's life? You know, that, emotionally, I understand the feeling that you would have. But halachically, if you can't save your life, you can't save their life. So even if they're going to die as a result of your refusal to worship Avodah Zarah, even if that would mean, God forbid, a person's own wife and children, he would not be allowed to do that. Okay, did you have one more question? Okay. Anyway, yeah.
Basically, the question is, what are the approaches to understanding the Holocaust?
Well, you know, actually, there's an interesting book that just came out recently. Rabbi Victor Miller had this book in manuscript for many, many years, and it just came out—a very long, long treatment of the Holocaust. You know, listen, the important thing to keep in mind is we have to differentiate between why individual people suffered and versus why Hashem allowed a tragedy of this magnitude to happen to Klal Yisrael as a whole. Why individual people suffered is a mystery that ultimately we cannot penetrate. That is the mystery of what Chazal call tzaddik v'ra'lo, that righteous people do suffer, and of course many people who died in the Holocaust were gaonim and tzaddikim and very, very righteous and holy, and we certainly cannot say about anybody they died because of their sins. Even a person who wasn't religious at all, we have no right to say that. Perhaps the people who died were greater tzaddikim, and that's why they died al kiddush Hashem. But I think what we can say, and this is really what Rev Miller talks about, is that if you look in the Teichacha, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu says that when the Jewish people as a whole, again, we're not focusing on individuals, when the Jewish people will wander away from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there is going to be wrath and destruction and galus and chorban. And just take out the book of Devarim and the book of Vayikra, and just read the verses, even without so much commentary, and you will really see that things like the Holocaust are spelled out in detail. It's not just general. Now, if you look, therefore, and again, I don't want to mention particular villains, so to speak, but it is undoubtedly the case that the 19th century and the early 20th century was a time of massive transformations of the Jewish people, in which large number of Jews were rejecting the Torah, they were leaving Yiddishkeit, they were seeking assimilation, they were seeking the cultures of the Umos HaOlam, and the Meshech Chochma wrote in the late 1800s, this was 40 years before Hitler, that those people who think that Berlin, the seat of culture, is the new Yerushalayim, shall see from Berlin a tremendous destruction. Now, this is 40 years before Hitler. Hitler was not even a private in Bavaria yet. So what I'm saying is we cannot say anything about any particular Jew. Why HaKadosh Baruch Hu chose this over that is beyond us. Certainly the Jews in Europe who died, many were much more righteous than the Jews in America who survived. But I think as a cosmic phenomenon, we do see when the Jewish nation rejects Hashem, there are very, very dramatic and difficult and tragic consequences. And this is the Tokacha. The Tokacha basically says, Hashem does not allow the Jewish people to wander away. And when we wander away, there will sometimes be extreme measures that will bring us back. And there's no question that the Holocaust in its awesome tragedy and darkness, was a major, major catalyst for the rededication of Jews to Torah. Because people felt a sense of urgency, a sense that I have to rebuild. Could there have been an easier way? Well, yeah, there could have been an easier way. This could have been avoided had we been able to internalize this message. So I would recommend that you look at Rav Miller's Sefer and he develops this. Okay, I'm sorry. Anyway, first I just want to give my own congratulations to everybody who did a Siyum. Again, it's a tremendous thing and something to be very, very proud of. And the Eberster certainly gets a lot of Nachas Ruach. And I hope for all of you and the people who aren't here as well that it be one of many, many, many Siyumim that you're zochet to do. And as Yisrael Salanter said, somebody asked him, how many times has this person been through Shas? Yisrael Salanter said, the more important question is, how many times has Shas been through you? So as you go through the Masechtas, may the Masechtas also go through you to elevate you, to purify you, and bring you closer to Hashem.